Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. So here at Drinks Insider, we are nothing if not happy to help. I have had a number of requests from American wine producers who want me to do more stories about potential export markets. So this episode is the first in an occasional series. Today's guest is Joris Snelton, CEO of Delta Wines, one of the biggest and most significant wine companies in the Netherlands. It's also an importer and distributor that handles more than 80 million bottles of wine a year, and it also has a presence in Belgium, Poland, the Czech Republic, and Finland. I met Joris some years ago and then caught up with him again recently at the Wine Academy in the Netherlands, where I was speaking one afternoon. It is a very unusual wine school in that it does the normal wine education and then has a fifth year that focuses on the business of wine, which is something I think that other countries should copy. And Joris has been teaching there since 2004. As you'll hear, there is practically nothing he doesn't know about the business, and he has a huge depth of knowledge about key European wine markets. As always, the takeaways will be in the newsletter, which you'll find at drinksinsider.com. And if you've got a suggestion for the podcast, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. Joris, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you, Felicity. Nice to be here.
Right. Can you start by talking about your own wine history and how you ended up working for Delta? And give me your background.
Yeah, so my background goes back to the hotel school in 1990. I was born in 1971. And I did the hotel school education. And I must say, my father was already very much busy with wine. Although he was not in the wine business, but he was a doctor, but there was a lot of wine in the house. And at a certain stage, I decided to go to the hotel school, which was very nice to do. And there was also interest on wine there. And then you had to do like a traineeship. And I didn't want to do it in a restaurant. I didn't want to do it in a hotel. And there was one location where I could do it. There was a wine shop. It was a high-end wine shop, the Golden Barrel, the Gouden Ton.
So was your wine-loving dad pleased that you got a job in a wine shop?
Very much, yeah.
Did he get a discount?
He was very happy that I went to that because it was his hobby. He had his own group of friends and his wine society and stuff. And so we went on holiday to France and living during the holidays in the chateau.
So the wine shop must have loved you that your doctor dad and his mates come into the shop. That's like the perfect job for you and for the employer.
Yeah, to be honest, I come from the south of the Netherlands, and the shop was in Den Haag, so there was quite a distance.
Oh, right.
And he was a very classical buyer, Bordeaux, and he had his own context where he could buy it. But then, that was a great experience, 6 months in the shop. And then I wanted to do another 6 months traineeship. And I didn't want to do it in a restaurant either, in a hotel. It was also an obligation of the hotel school to do it in another company. And then they organized a second traineeship in the import company of that same wine shop. That was called a Residence. And I spent 6 months there. I did my import traineeship together with Urs Vetter. Maybe you know him from Vietti. And he was a great teacher for me. So I spent 6 months. They gave me a job. I spent there for 3 years working as his assistant, doing purchasing and some sales. But then I decided also that I want to learn more about wine, and that you cannot do that in the Netherlands. You have to go to France. Well, at that moment, France was the most important country, of course, for wine production. And so I took a decision, 6 months traveling all around, organizing my traineeships in Margaux. I did it in Bergerac, I did it in Côte-du-Rhône, I did it in Plemont, in the Gascony. So, and every time, like 1 week, 2 weeks, a month. And that was great. 6 months of working in the technical part, in the vineyards also. Chateau Pavie I did, for example, and Chateau Trignon. It was really interesting. But then again, I also said, if I really want to know more, I have to go to do study in wine vinification. And there I decided to do a brevet technicien agricole at La Tour Blanche in the Sauterne, which is like a technical study. I was the only non-French person participating, which was very interesting and a great way to learn French language, because you dream it. Like every morning you stand up with your colleagues, and in the evening you drink and have dinner together. And so my French is very good since then.
Whereas I've only once had a dream in German. And in that dream I was in trouble.
Oh yeah. Well, it means that you manage it and you have the language skills. And so after that 1 year and a half, I decided to go for Montpellier to another higher level, Brevet Technicien Supérieur Agricole, VTNO, and then more the technical commercial side of wine. So that was till 96. And then the owner of Delta Wines, at that time, I was always in good contact with him because he arranged a traineeship for me at Pleinmont. And he contacted me and said, okay, when you're finished with all those studies in France, I want you to come back to the Netherlands because I need someone in my company to follow me up, basically. He's giving me a lot of trust because I was not, he didn't know me that well, but he saw in me the future. And I said, well, I don't want to go now because I want to go to Argentina. I want to go to Chile. I want to do lots of vinification experience elsewhere. And then he made a super deal. He said, okay, come over. You will work 10 months per year in my company. And 2 months, I will give you freedom to do a vinification as long as it's with one of my suppliers of Delta Wines. So that's how I did vinification at Vinos de Vero.
Now, I'm just going to jump in. Can you explain who Delta Wines is and what position it holds in the Netherlands?
Yeah, so it's a wine importer, it's a distributor. Basically, what we don't do, and that's the most important, we do not sell directly to the consumer. And we do not sell directly to the restaurants. So we always work with resellers, so either supermarkets, wine shops, liquor stores, duty-free airliners, online players, wholesalers.
So it's a very significant company. You're involved in all segments of the market.
Yeah, basically all channels. Yeah.
And apart from the Netherlands, how many other markets are you involved in?
Six in total now. So the Netherlands since 1985, when the company was created. And then we did Poland in 2010 with Anka Wines. Then we did the Czech Republic 2012 with Advil. Then Belgium 21. And then Norway and Finland last year.
Oh, okay. So why Belgium so late when it's right next door?
Good question. Yeah. What we did do is some export to Belgium, and it's not a very easy market to be honest. It's very fragmented. It's very traditional. And we just did not came across the right company. And I must say, when we said to ourselves in 2009, we wanted to extend outside the Netherlands to be less depending on the Dutch market only. And we were looking at, okay, what would be the most interesting growing countries in consumption, which is often growing in economy, yeah? Because if they make more money, a consumer will spend more money on wine. That's a rule, because they go on holiday to Tuscany or to wherever, and they like the wine and they want to drink it at home. So Poland for us was more important than Belgium. And same for the Czech Republic. And then Belgium, well, it's a funny story, because we were offered a company which was called Delta Fijne Wijnen, which means Delta Fine Wines. And they basically carried the part of our name, but they created the company longer ago. So for us, it was like a logical thing. Let's take over Delta Fijne Wijnen in Belgium to be part of the family.
Well, I think the Polish one must have been a very good decision, because if you look at Europe at the moment, it's the Polish economy which is still rocketing along while everybody else is not rocketing along.
Yeah, so basically what we see in Poland is the same like the Netherlands, let's say 40 years ago, where there was a high consumption of beer, spirits, and consumption of wine was quite low. And the moment people in the Netherlands started to travel and have more money, the consumption of spirits, Geneva, went down, beer went down, and then wine consumption went up. And we see exactly the same development in Poland, but it's going much faster.
Okay, let's talk about Poland in a second. But first of all, let's start talking about the Netherlands and specifically talk about wine. Can you talk about how the wine market is segmented in terms of how much is fine wine, how much of it is commodity wine? What does it look like?
Yeah, so that's bad news. Basically, the Netherlands, the pays bas, les prix bas, as the French say, we have a reputation of low pricing. And it went up because of inflation. But if you look at the average consumer price in the supermarkets, it's €4.50 almost.
And how much of that is wine and how much of that is tax?
Well, that's also less good news. Well, it's not as bad as in the UK, but it's around...
Nobody's as bad as the UK.
77 euro cents per bottle for alcohol duty and ecotax.
Wow.
70 cents. And then there's 21% of VAT. But if you add the margin of the importer and the distributor, then it's quite a lot of tax which is inside. So it doesn't leave a lot of, let's say, room for the wine producer if you want to be at that €4.49 average price, where the sweet spot is, of course, €3.99 because the consumer likes to buy a Chardonnay or Sauvignon at €3.99. But then, yeah, the ex-works price is quite low.
Who supplies the market? Who can supply at that price at volume?
Well, you see a big growth of Spain, obviously, mm-hmm. because with their cheaper level of bulk wines, they can, and that's what you see in the statistics also, that Tempranillo is growing. We've been growing a lot with Romania because of an excellent quality price ratio. Chile is doing a job there, South Africa, of course. But let's say the more classical French regions, they have more difficulties at that price level. And that's what you've seen in the last 10 years. The market share of France has suffered quite a lot.
Yeah, Romania is actually a great production country. I went out there in 2018 and the quality is fantastic.
Totally,
they're really doing a good job.
Yeah, I was there a couple of months ago also to taste the new vintage and with Carmela Recas, which is our supplier. And yeah, they make excellent wines.
Okay, so how much of the Dutch market is the supermarket? Is that the majority of what's sold?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So of the home consumption, it's around 80 to 85% of what's consumed at home is coming from the supermarkets. So they are definitely leading the market. And then the other, say 20% is the traditional trade, wine shops, liquor stores, and online. And then the average price, I would say, on the traditional trade, so everything outside the supermarket, is around €8, €8.30. So to be in a premium above €10, it's really a very small small part of the market.
Okay, so all of my American listeners have just switched off the podcast at this point, they're crying. Is the premium segment growing? Is it shrinking? What's happening at that end?
Well, that was the only good thing of Corona, I must say, is that it made people discover that if they would pay 2, 3, 4, 5 euros more, they would like the wine much more and they would stick to that higher price level if they have the financial capacity, of course. So it's not given to everybody. What we've seen during Corona, people started to cook at home. Instead of going to the restaurant, they would buy a bottle of €25 in a wine shop, which is still less expensive than a bottle of house wine in a restaurant. And they would taste it. It was amazing higher quality than a house wine in a restaurant. So that really did a good thing. So we've seen the traditional wine shops growing a lot, the business. Online went skyrocketing, of course, also. But that was like temporary because when restaurants were open again and people could buy the wines from the shops, then online went back not to the old level, but it suffered quite a lot in the last year.
So I'm interested in something you said a couple of minutes ago, which is, moving from a beer culture to one that begins to drink wine. What drove that? How do you turn the ship around from, spirits and beer into becoming a wine culture? What were the drivers of that?
Well, I think it's a real interest of the consumer. It's also, the supermarkets are responsible of it also, because the supermarkets, and that's different compared to the UK, for example. Every supermarket will have its own brands, which can be Torres, which can be Lindemans or whatsoever. And they can make a higher margin on these products. So they would spend more time and energy and promotions on selling wine because they can make a difference compared to the competitor. They have their own category. And I think it's the supermarkets, Albert Heijn, they started to drive that so that the consumer said, okay, let's buy a bottle of wine. Education helped also. You see quite a big group of people who do like a wine training, like WSET, first level or second level, and in the Netherlands.
Is that wine professionals or is that alcohol professionals?
Also consumers, but also professionals, of course. And this way you create ambassadors. So we have a lot of wine shops. We have online players. We have a lot of sommeliers who tell stories at the table. So it was really like every year we've seen a growth of consumption till 2018, up to 22 liters per capita. And then after that, with Corona, there was a big spike again, but now it's suffering a bit because of health reasons. But we'll probably talk about that later on.
Yeah. Now, in your presentation, which you sent me, you said that the Netherlands is losing 800,000 wine consumers.
Yeah.
What's is that? I've written down a week. It can't possibly be a week. It must be a
year.
But
we lose 800,000 weekly drinkers. So
weekly drinkers. Oh, yeah, because if the Netherlands was losing 800,000 people a week, would be like the Black Death.
No. So it's more that regular routine buyer, which I would say the more the boomers, which would drink a wine every day or every 2 days. That's a group which is shrinking. Because they get at a certain age, they get old or they die. And then the younger group of consumers, the millennials or I, Z, whatever, they drink less. They don't have that routine of drinking every week. So we basically lose on that group of consumers. Yeah.
Now, one of the things that people talk about in other countries, I've sat through presentations in Australia, New Zealand and the United States, is that they say younger drinkers aren't necessarily drinking less, though there is that group as well, but they're drinking more widely across more categories. What are you seeing in Holland?
Yeah, totally. No, that's what we see. There's more competition in seltzers, hard seltzers or cocktails or special fermented teas or also alcohol-free products, which are competing with wine, definitely. And that's beer. There was like a big spike in the sales of specialty beers, local beers. That's now over. You see quite some breweries who don't make it anymore. They have to close the door. But that was a big growth of specialty beers because it's like individual package, small bottles. So everybody could take his own taste and have one bottle for their own taste, whereas a bottle of wine is 75 centiliters and you need to share it with a group of people.
And are you seeing any growth in alternative, what's called alternative packaging, like cans, half bottles, bag in box?
We do. So we do see with the younger consumer, they are more open-minded for it. So the older generation is more like bottles, 75 centiliter glass. And the younger is more open-minded, either with pouches or small PET bottles, cans, but it's not as big as in the UK yet. So it's not growing that fast, at least what we see in our figures. Cans are not doing that well. We do PET bottles, and bag-in-box is also not going as fast as we see in the Nordics, but there's a growth.
And in that same presentation that I'll keep referring to, you said that although young people are buying less wine, when they do, they're more engaged. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that's really the good news, and that makes us more, let's say, positive, motivated, because they're not that routine drinkers like the boomers, where they say, okay, I have my Chardonnay every week, or Merlot or whatever. They're really honestly interested in knowing more about, okay, where's the wine coming from, about the wine grower, about sustainability, about a special grape variety. So they're really more engaged and interested, and they're willing to spend more. But they will buy less bottles in a week. So basically volume is down, but the engagement and the average pricing is going up.
So is the increase in value making up for the loss of volume?
It does. Yeah, not totally, because the loss this year is, I believe, it's minus 6% almost this year in the supermarkets, and volume is down. And then the value is going up a bit, but it's not compensating. So on the whole, the turnover is below index 100.
Right. And one of the other sort of the gloomy things that you said in that presentation was that you said there were more bankruptcies happening in the wine trade. Was that people who just got too excited about the spike during COVID, or what's driving that?
Yeah, sometimes it's bankruptcy. Sometimes they just close the door. I think it's a wider problem. I mean, there are too many restaurants. There are too many liquor stores. There are too many importers. And if the market is shrinking, as is happening now, people see that it's not sustainable anymore to continue, because with the inflation, and it's becoming much more complicated to run an import company, because with all the certifications, all the things you need to do to be in aligned with government wishes. I do hear a lot of importers, they say, there's no fun anymore. I mean, 20 years ago, it was much easier.
So these weren't people who, you know, the wine trade is plagued by people who are doing it for a hobby, or people who are doing it in their retirement who don't really understand what they're getting into. So you're not talking about those people, you're just talking about people who've been in the trade for a while.
Both, basically. Yeah. So the smaller, which we call the hobby importers, they always be there. I mean, they used to be like a professor in French language, and they go on holiday, and then they start with a small import company. And basically, you can say that 120 importers in the Netherlands, they do 80% or even 90% of the total business. But then you still have 1,000 of importers. They do all fragmented, and they all have their own, which I'm fine with it, because they're all like ambassadors. Let them talk about wine and create consumers to drink wine. So I don't see a problem with them.
Well, this is a very important point for somebody who might be looking to move into the Dutch market. How do you know the difference between somebody who's just a little hobbyist and somebody who you should be doing business with? What sort of questions should you ask?
Well, I would first ask them, okay, if you want to be an importer, do you think about working capital? Do you think about, okay, what you import? How fast are you going to sell it? What is going to be your payment conditions with the producer? How fast are you going to get the money? Because, I mean, our stock rotation is 6 weeks, but for a small importer, it's like 3 months. But the bad ones, they are up to 6 months. So they have to pay the producer, they don't get the money, and at a certain stage they have a problem, because the wine is getting either too old, or they need to order one wine from a producer which is sold out, but they don't need the other wines from that producer. So they have to pick up one pallet from the south of Italy, which is horribly expensive. So I'm trying to explain them, okay, think about it before you start to do it. Maybe it's wiser to start selling wine to restaurants and consumers by buying wine from our company. And that's obviously, I'm have an interest there to motivate them to sell wines from our company. And then they can buy 4 times per week what they need out of an assortment of 3,500 wines, which we have. So we basically advise them, don't start to be an importer, or you must be extremely good and very specialized in Piemonte wines, for example, or you're the best in Burgundy. But that's difficult now to find new producers who are not yet on the Dutch market at that, let's say, premium level.
Yeah. So if you are a wine producer, on the other hand, and you're looking to get into the Dutch market, again, if there are this many importers, some of them you clearly shouldn't deal with. So if you were advising a producer, what sort of questions should they ask of an importer?
Well, they should try to understand first what they really want. I mean, what is the volume they want to sell in what channel? Are they more like for the restaurants? Are they more for wine shops? Is it more for the supermarket? So they need to know what they want, and then look at the importer which is the best fit for it. But yeah, at the same time, you have to realize. I mean, we get like. I mean, in my email box, I get like 20 proposals every day of a producer who's not yet in the Dutch market. And I think it's our role as an importer to handle them every time. So I send them to my buying team and tell them, okay, look at it at least and see if we have a gap in a certain country or price level or whatsoever. But yeah, the producer should be really interested in the partner and really trying to understand what is needed to create business. And yeah, obviously that's where it often goes wrong, because there are so many producers and they are so passionate about their wine and they want to sell that wine. But many times they are not fit for the Dutch market.
This thing about being flooded with emails from producers, I've heard this from buyers a lot. And their number one complaint is the person sending them the email says, I have this wine, I do this, and they don't look at the assortment and look at what's missing. What for you is the offer that you immediately discard versus the one that you go, oh, that could be interesting?
Yeah, well, the one I immediately discard is if I receive an email which they don't put my name in the email, but they put the name of a competitor. So they,
don't do that, listeners. Don't do that.
That's really copy paste what they're doing. And that's really, then I know, okay, if you already start to do communicate like this, it means you will make errors in the future. If they are, I receive emails that I don't understand what's the region where the wine is coming from. So I have to go to the website and see that it's coming from X part of Italy or whatever. So they should show a real interest in the company by saying, okay, I looked at your website. I see that you already work with the producer. But I think we have a proposal which could be of interest because of that and that reason. So they should first really try to understand our structure, what the Dutch market is needing, and what our company would need. And then, I mean, what a normal salesman needs to do is first to ask the right questions and to discover instead of just blowing your offer as a PDF.
Okay. And what about moving up to other segments? What about the low and no alcohol segment? What are you seeing there?
Well, that's for us, it's, I mean, a very important category for multiple reasons. First of all, people drink less alcohol. That's because of the whole government rulings and the whole anti-alcohol lobby, which is one Dutch journalist, he calls them the anti-alcohol Taliban.
Tell me about that. How is the anti-alcohol lobby affecting?
Yeah, it's a quite strong one, and they're quite close to the government, and they really get a role. And there was like at a certain moment we were trying to get like a sort of everybody at the table, the alcohol industry and the anti-alcohol lobby and the government, and just to have like a good conversation. But they obviously they don't want that, and they're really in a sort of more aggressive way telling how bad alcohol is and cancer and all those stories. And definitely, yeah, the new WHO direction doesn't help. So they picked that up immediately. Like, you see, there's no safe level of alcohol.
Yes, I mean, Dutch television is running ads saying alcohol gives you cancer. Is that right?
Yeah. So because in Dutch you say gezondheid when you toast. Gezond means, hey, have a healthy life. And they basically say, how can you say healthy life drinking alcohol? So these kind of advertisements certainly don't help the consumption.
Since they started running those ads, have you seen a decline in sales?
Well, is that because of those ads, or is it because of a changing consumer of competition in alcohol categories, other alcohol categories? Is it inflation? So it's a mix. I don't think it's only because of that, but it certainly doesn't help the consumption.
Yeah, anyway, I interrupted you. You were talking about the importance of no and low.
And so I think about 6 years ago, we said to ourselves, okay, it's going to be important to have non-alcohol wine in our category, because there's a group of consumers, either they are pregnant or they are at a certain age with medication and so forth. They don't want to have alcohol. We want to keep them in our wine category. We don't want them to go to soft drinks or to ginger tea, or we don't want them to go to fermented tea or whatsoever. So at that same time, we felt with our traditional clients, they were a bit hesitating. Alcohol-free wine, it doesn't taste good, and I don't drink it at home, so I won't sell it. And we were trying to say, listen, also even our salespeople, they were not very motivated to sell these products. And we came across to a company, La Source, which was specialized in alcohol-free wines in the Netherlands. And we took over that company together with the person working in that company. And he was a real ambassador for alcohol-free wine. So to get him on board to be an ambassador to our colleagues internal in the company, but also towards our clients and the journalist, that really made momentum for us. Because suddenly we became, from an importer also having some products alcohol-free, we became a specialist in alcohol-free products. And that really has given us momentum. And now we tell to the traditional wine shop, listen, you must take something like alcohol-free wines on board, because if you don't, the consumer will go either to the supermarket or to your competitor, or it will take alcohol-free beer. And what you want is to sell wine with or without alcohol. And so that's for us, it's important.
The alcohol-free wines can be very challenging. I've drunk a fair few of them now. And the alcohol, one of the things that strikes me is the de-alcoholizing process generally makes them all taste the same. I find it quite difficult to taste.
It's true. We have some exceptions, and I think we have a very good role position now with Colonna Nul. I don't know if you know
the brand.
And that's more in the, it's €14, so I believe €12 per bottle for the sparkling. And yes, that's quite a high price. But if you taste it, and you know, yesterday I made a presentation to the Magister Vini, which you also did some weeks ago, just to show the quality. And people are really positive about the quality. So I think if you start with a high quality base wine and you de-alkalize, then you will get a better alcohol-free wine. But it's a high price class. So at €4, €5 alcohol-free, yeah, it's not necessarily something I would recommend.
Yeah, okay. So, all right. So how do you build brands in the Dutch market? You mentioned that supermarkets all have their own brands. So if you wanted to get into the Dutch market, so I'm pretending I'm a wine producer here, what can I do to build a brand, or is that up to the supermarket to do?
Yeah, so I think on one side, it's a good thing, I would say, for us as a company, is that brands are not so big in the Netherlands, because if it would be as big as beer with Heineken or Gols or whatsoever, then there wouldn't be a role for us as a middleman. And if brands would be so big that they would open their own offices in the Netherlands, then we wouldn't have a role. So we're quite happy that every supermarket wants to have their own brand, that every, let's say, sales channel, traditional trade, online, everybody wants to have his own label and their own brand. Same for the on-trade. They don't want to have a brand which is in the supermarket. So real brands in the Netherlands don't really exist.
Oh, that's interesting. That's so interesting. Yeah. So although it might be a lower margin country, you don't have all the added costs of all the brand building. That's interesting.
Yeah, and I think it's a good thing in one way. And I mean, I've seen examples of people saying, hey, I'm going to build a brand in the Netherlands, putting lots of money on the table to build that brand, but basically they've burned more than they made profit out of it. So the real brands are those who are with the market leaders of the supermarkets, so Albert Heijn, yeah, Lindemans, it's a brand, but is it a real brand? You won't find it in the on-trade. You won't find it in a wine shop. You won't find it online. You will only find it with Albert Heijn. So for me, is it a brand? Internationally, yes, but on the Dutch scale, it's less.
How much work do wine companies have? If they get a listing in the Netherlands, can they just go, thanks very much, guys, we'll deliver the wine? Or do they have to be there all the time talking to people? What's the work level if you want to be listed?
Well, it depends on the positioning. So, I mean, if it would be like a Chardonnay at the consumer price of €6, I mean, then it's our task to make sure that these products will get the perfect distribution, because we have like 800 points of sale, and then the product will sell by itself because of a high quality, a nice packaging, and you don't need a producer to do storytelling. But if we're talking about something like a special grape variety from Piemonte, and it's costing €30 per bottle, it will not fly away, and you need to convey the message, to pass the message to the sommelier or to the wine shop. So then we organize like masterclasses or tastings, or we introduce them to journalists, and then to get that message rolling. And then we need the support of the producer.
Now, the role of bulk wine, how much wine is shipped and then bottled in the Netherlands, or does it all come in as bottled wine?
Yeah, now it's mainly bottled wine, because the bottling companies that did exist in the Netherlands, they are basically shut down. So you had WineXL, which was taken over by Invivo Cordier, and they closed down that bottling line, and there was another bottling line which is closed down. So
why? What drove that?
Well, I mean, if you look at, there's an overcapacity of bottling lines. You've got the big players like Grand Chier de France and Mertes and so forth. So they're terribly big. They are super efficient. And if you're a small Dutch country and have your bottling line, and you do maybe, I don't know, 25 million bottles per year on that bottling line, compared to Mertes, who's doing, I don't know, 200 million bottles, you will never be as efficient. So, I mean, it's for the UK, it's useful because it's a much bigger market. But for the Netherlands, to have your own bottling line is not really interesting.
So it all comes into the Netherlands as bottles.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah, so we do buy some bulk, and there's the bulk fair soon coming.
Next week.
Yeah, exactly. And then we do buy it, and then we look for a bottling company either in Germany or Belgium or Denmark. We're looking at who's the most efficient, and as there is an overcapacity, it's always better to not have your own bottling line. That's my conviction.
Let's talk about sustainability. Now, you mentioned something in your presentation about a government deadline. Can you talk about what sustainability rules there are around selling wine in the Netherlands?
Well, it's more about the Dutch government saying that if you have a certain scale of a size as a company, you need to be aligning with the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive.
And that sounds scary. What's that?
Well, that's scary indeed, because you need to register everything, all the CO2 emissions. You need to really work on an accountancy report on all the steps you're doing as a company, and you need to improve every year. So in the past, you could say, okay, we were green, and we do have over 1,000 solar panels on our company, but now they want you to register everything, the movements of the trucks, what are you going to do to decrease the CO2 emissions, and that needs to be an accountancy report. If you're a big company, you need to align with that. And all the supermarkets, obviously, they are big companies.
Do you have to get all of that information from your suppliers as well?
Yeah. So it's a combination of your suppliers, but also from your transporter, for basically everybody in the value chain.
Does that change who you can buy wine from? Like, are there some countries that are really, really good at reporting and some that just go, it's too hard?
Yeah, well, we're going to discover that in the future, because I must say it's still a bit in a starting phase, because if you talk to producers, many producers don't know what you're talking about. But it will become very important, because if you work with a supermarket, as we do, they want us to be certified, and they want us to be aligned with those CSRD, and they want us to make accountancy reports by saying, okay, the wine which we sell to you, there's so much CO2 emission, which means we need to go back to the producer. And if they're not ready to do it, then we have a problem. So this is quite a big nightmare.
I mean, that's a really, really big, yeah. You know, all of these things are great in principle, but having to track down what your suppliers are doing on a tractor in a vineyard somewhere in Europe is tough.
Exactly. So I think there will be at least we're working in that on an industry standard by saying, okay, if the wine is coming from, let's say, South Africa, then we can make sort of an assumption that there's the container transport by the boat, which would be this CO2. And then if the vineyards are more coastal or are they more swartland, then the driving distance is a bit more, so that you can work on certain standards and not going on every detail for every bottle of wine for every producer.
Is that something that's going to be European wide, or is that just something you're going to do for the Dutch market?
That's European wide, because it's European law.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I mean, are you working with other companies and other places in Europe to work out that sort of uniform standard, or is that standard being worked out in the EU?
In the Netherlands, no. Yeah, it's mainly now we have the Association of Dutch Wine Importers, the KVNW, and so that's like 120 members, and we're now looking into the right consultancy firm to advise us on that, and there's either Dutch or international.
Gosh, that is quite the challenge. And where do consumers sit in this? How much do consumers care about sustainability versus how much do they say they care about sustainability?
Yeah, that's a good question, because that's often what supermarkets say, because from a board level, they say, okay, we need to put more attention on fair trade bananas or wine, or we need to have more organic wines. And obviously, organic wines are more expensive. But the consumer is not always ready to pay that premium, certainly not when it's more inflation and more tough times, because I always like to give that as an example, which I heard from a supermarket organization in the Netherlands. The value for a family, four people, mother, father and two kids, how much do they spend on evening dinner, including dessert? Do you have an idea how much it would be in the Netherlands?
No idea at all. I can't even tell you what my own dinner would be.
Okay. Well, often if I ask that question to people, they would say, well, 20 euro, 25 and so forth. At that time, and it's now 10 years ago, it was 6 euro 90.
For what? For the whole family?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So probably it's now 10 euro. But at that time, I mean, it's possible if you're a student, you buy pasta and some cheap sauce and you have like a vanilla dessert. I mean, you can do it as a student. So a bottle of wine of 4 euro 49 in that basket of, let's say, 10 euro now for the full, and we're talking about a family, obviously, with not a high income, but that's, yeah, a majority of the people in the Dutch market. So that bottle of 4.50 euro is half of the basket almost value of a dinner. So would they be...
Yeah, but if you drink the wine, you forget about the fact you're eating rice.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I suppose if you cook in bulk, you could do it. But gosh, that is a tight budget.
Yeah.
At the higher level of the market, do you think people care about sustainability?
They do. Yeah, there you see more in the specialist wine stores or the sommeliers. They really tell the story about, okay, this is a producer. He's not using any pesticides, herbicides, fungicides. So, but then obviously it's a totally different price level, because then it's 15 euro, 20 euro, then it's easier to make a sustainable wine. But interesting story is also, because I remember I had a discussion with a supermarket where we were selling a fair trade wine from South Africa. And the producer didn't raise the price for 3 years. And I believe it was a consumer price of 4.99 euro, fair trade wine. And then the producer wanted to increase his price with probably 30 euro cents or something like that. And then the supermarket buyer refused to accept that price increase. And I was trying to explain, we're talking about fair trade. It's fair trade. It's going to the producer. But they say, yeah, but I mean, Lidl and Aldi, they're also selling fair trade wines at that price level. We cannot go up. So sorry, basically. And then he lost the business. And so it's a difficult discussion.
God, it's not really in the spirit of fair trade. Can we turn and talk about some of the other markets you're involved in? Can you go through the same process maybe and talk about Poland?
Yeah, so Poland, as I said, it's really, I mean, we're now since 2010 there, and I mean, I'm going there every year, and it's incredible to see the change of the market, the more fancy restaurants and the more sommeliers and the people talking about wines, having more knowledge and doing traineeships, and we've really seen the Polish market increasing. Obviously, it's still a price market. So there's a lot of the bigger supermarkets who do run the show. But what I do see also at the same time, there's more specialist stores, and there's more. We don't do online because that's still difficult there in Poland. It's not really clear what you're allowed to do and what you're not. But we really see like a growing interest and spending power from the Polish consumer, and that's really growing the category.
And do you see different taste profiles between Polish and Dutch consumers?
Yes, if you look to the past, there was more sweetness, more residual sugar, and that's still there. I mean, if you look for the more and lower cheaper, the lower entry wines, it's still the case. But if you go for the more traditional wine stores and restaurants, there you see the same level as we have in the Netherlands.
Yeah, and what about the Czech Republic? How's that developing as a market?
Yeah, it's also for us an interesting market. Obviously, it's a producer itself. So I believe 50% of the consumption is wines which are produced in the Czech Republic. Italy has always done very well. We are mainly in the supermarket business with our company, with the Advil. Also, there are tough supermarkets negotiating hard. They don't give you a lot of space to earn more money.
Is that because they've all been to business school and they're really good negotiators, or is that just because they don't have lots of money?
Good question. I think it's a mix of both, I would say.
This is the Czechs. Okay, so the Czechs are really hard-nosed, is what we just learned.
Yeah.
Are there any of the cultures you deal with that are easier, easier to negotiate with than others?
Well, if you look at Belgium, I mean, also there we do business with the supermarkets. They don't give you space either.
So they're tough too.
Exactly. It's the same. And then, we're also in Norway and Finland. And you obviously know about the whole monopoly structure there. So that's really, which for us was interesting to see, because we went into those markets because we thought there was no... No, I would say we didn't go into those markets for many years because we thought monopoly, nobody will earn any money there. But then we made a deep dive because we were talking to a certain company which we maybe would have taken over. And then we saw a high profitability, that they do make a lot of money in those countries. Because if you win the tender, you win the tender.
And whereas they pay you on time.
Exactly. Where if you win a tender with Aldi in the Netherlands, you don't really win it, because they come back to you, say, okay, you're the best in quality, you're number one, but your price is too high. And they always will negotiate. So they always will cutting down on your margin. Whereas in the monopoly country, you win the tender, end of the line, you will not negotiate on the pricing. So that's why we saw quite a lot of importers making interesting money, and that we said, okay, that's a profitable market to go into and see if we can disrupt a little bit by taking less margin.
For listeners, there's Norway and Finland are what called monopoly markets. So alcohol has to be sold through the government stores, Van Monopoly in Norway and Alko in Finland. There's a lot of importers already in those countries supplying them, but you never, of course, know if you're going to get a tender or not. So you as a Dutch company outside those countries, how do you supply them? I mean, what can you do that somebody in those markets can't do?
Yeah, so what we did is, I mean, we're not there as Dutch people. So we work with wine professionals who've been in the business for a long time. So Stefan Norberg, for example, he used to be with Solera and Suzanne. And so there are people who all used to work for the Solera company, which was taken over by Unibrew. And because of the change in that company, they stepped out of Solera. And basically, they started to make a joint venture, greenfield company, but with a lot of experience from their side in that market. So we're not green. I mean, we're starting new. And then basically with the producers, as we have as Delta Wines in those other five or four countries, we're now motivating them to move over to our company in Norway or Finland.
I imagine that's an easy thing to argue for because, monopoly markets are known for being often quite better to work with than places elsewhere. It's interesting. Okay, so final thoughts with your involvement with all of these markets, do you see any bright spots anywhere?
Do I see bright spots? Well, I think for many years we've seen that trend that people will drink less but better. And we've moved away from the real entry level. So we don't do any wines below, €4, because there's no reason to be in that value chain, because you will be kicked out either by the supermarket or the producer will kick you out. So for the last 6 years, we've been investing a lot in also in Poland and the Netherlands and also in Belgium in the more traditional trade, the on-trade, to make sure that you're on the wine lists of those restaurants. And we do see a growing consumer going to restaurants. So that's where we now take the growth. So we're not totally stepping away from the supermarket, but we said, okay, that's going to be such a commodity business where our role, I mean, it's still there. We have big brands and big volumes, but the margins are so cut. It's not really fun to be there. And we want to think also in a sustainable way towards the producer, because if you only buy those entry-level wines, but you don't do anything out of their portfolio higher up, then you're not interesting for them. So our strategy is to a mix all the channels from, yes, supermarkets, big volumes, but also traditional trade, wine shops, on-trade, online, duty-free, and as a whole to make an interesting package for the producer. And there we see silver lining for the future. And as Delta Wines, I mean, we're now in 6 countries. We do like 80 million bottles. We think there the consolidation, as is happening in every country, there should also be a consolidation in Europe. So I think there's too many importers all over fighting. And I think we should work more together over the countries and to be a stronger partner to the supermarkets who also work international. I mean, if you look at the Jumbo, they are in the Netherlands and in Belgium. Ahold, they are also in the Czech Republic and in Belgium and in the Netherlands. So if your client's getting in multi-country, as an importer, you need to be stronger in those countries also and work together and to have more leverage, more skill.
I have a project for you. Can you please fix the wine offering at Schiphol Airport? I got stuck there a few weeks ago and it was really grim.
Okay. Why did they want it? Because it was too complex for them to... Well, what wine was it? Well, we can talk about it later on.
No, there wasn't even any. There was like one or two choices of little bottles of wine, and they were terrible.
Oh, you were there. Okay. And you mean it wasn't
like,
a shop?
I was expecting, like in most airports, there's usually a bar, and you can have a choice. And in the area of Schiphol Airport, where you fly out to Germany, there's no choice. And if you could fix that, that would be great.
Okay, I'll work on that.
Thank you very much, Doris. Thanks very much for your time today.
Pleasure.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome. Thank you.